The presidential motorcade has just passed through heavy crowds in downtown Dallas and was circling through the fringes of the business district when three shots suddenly rang out.
Destroying the media lies and dismantling the narratives. One story at a time. It's the Adrian Slade Show.
So, Illinois is the new Venezuela. Illinois-lazuela. Welcome to the failed state. I'm Adrian Slade. Thanks for tuning in. This is what happens when Democrats get their way. This is what happens when you allow big government to take root. Basically, what happens is big government expands ever further, employing more and more, taking away from the private sector. And in doing so, you then have to obligate yourself to how you're going to, you know, provide some sort of retirement as an incentive to work. And instead of looking towards other means, you know, investments, investment vehicles, things you can put retirement in, you basically say, well, we're going to give you this plan where you've worked with us for 30 years. We're then going to turn around and provide you, via tax money, all of these dollars, all of this amount of money is going to come to you every year until you pass away or expire. And so when you have enough people on the bill, well, then who's paying for it? I mean, it starts to become cannibalized. It starts to eat itself because there is no outside revenue source coming in. So then it begins to collapse. You know, if you have everybody in the state, and it's also an arrogance of the liberals, by the way, to think that, well, you know, we've got such great industry here in Chicago, and we've got such great industry in the state, and, you know, that who cares? Those companies can get taxed and deal with it. Those people that live in those suburbs that do well, they can get taxed and deal with it, and it's okay, and it'll all take care of itself. But at a certain point, one begins to outweigh the other, and that's what we're looking at. Like I was saying, it starts to cannibalize itself, and it starts to topple over. And much as any socialist, you know, display, any socialist Marxist example can be, such as Venezuela, we're now witnessing it in America with Illinois, Chicago, Dodge City 2.0, the home of the community organizer-in-chief Barack Obama, and the birthplace of Communist Party United States of America, CPUSA, Red Star Magazine, Frank Marshall Davis, anything related to the communist movement set up shop in Chicago. And Chicago being the murder capital of the country, that right there should show you that liberal policies have failed, because it's been run by liberals for decades and decades, and yet nothing improves. And so not only do we have the crime rate and the mortality rate skyrocketing in Chicago itself, now the entire state's about to crumble. And one of the proposals that I'm hearing is we should divide up Illinois. You know, we should give part of it to Indiana, part of it to Kentucky, part of it wherever. How about we just make new states out of it? And then we build a solar wall around it. We toss some bongo drums, some hacky sacks, maybe bags of kale, and then just let them go to town. I mean, you'll see the emissions of marijuana rising while they complain about emissions from your vehicles causing climate issues. But we'll all see, it'll look like China. China with a lot of weed, a lot of skunk weed. And, you know, I don't have any interest in bailing out Illinois. We as taxpayers shouldn't have any interest in bailing out Illinois. But eventually, after we carve up Illinois into parts like maybe East Illinois, we're going to have to financially bail them out because they're going to support stupid ideas like pop-up cupcake shops and overpriced coffee in favor of actual industry. So what's going to happen with Illinois? I was reading this funny column from John Cass from the Chicago Tribune. It's basically a satirical look at what's going on with Illinois and the proposals that are being made. But it goes, Illinois is like Venezuela now, a fiscally broken state that has lost its will to live, although for the moment, we still have enough toilet paper. But before we run out of essentials, let's finally admit that after a decade upon decade of taxing and spending and borrowing, Illinois has finally run out of other people's money. Those other people include taxpayers who've abandoned the state. And now Illinois faces doomsday. So as the politicians meet in Springfield this week for another round of posturing and gesturing and blaming, we need a plan. And here it is. Dissolve Illinois. Decommission the state, tear up the charter, whatever the lego mumbo jumbo is, just end the whole dang thing. We just disappear. With no pain. That's right, you heard me. The best thing to do is break Illinois into pieces. Just wipe us off the map. Cut us out of America's heartland and let the neighboring states carve us up and take the best chunks for themselves. The group that will scream the loudest is the state's political class. Who did this to us? The big bond creditors who are whispering talks of bankruptcy and asset forfeiture to save their own skins. But our beloved Illinois has proved that it just doesn't deserve to survive. So why not let our friendly neighbors like Indiana, Wisconsin, Iowa, Missouri, and Kentucky just take down the parts they want? As you can see by the excellent Kevorkian Illinois map that he had displayed, which is pretty interesting, this plan is visionary. The alternative is hell. Illinois hasn't had a state budget for years. Sound familiar? The state continues to spend money it doesn't have. Sound familiar? I'm adding those in, by the way. The state's credit rating has dropped. Sounds familiar. Thanks, Obama, for that one. But back to the article. Increasing the cost of borrowing. More money. We don't have to keep the rotten shebang going. Bills pile up. Moody's Investor Services taxpayers are on the hook for $251 billion in unfunded public union pensions and liabilities. Boss Mike Madigan, king of the Democrats who control things, wants tax increases but no real structural reform to bring stability to the Venezuela of the Midwest. And the whispers of bankruptcy won't help the average remaining tax-paying shrubs like you and me who don't want to leave our homes, who will get stuck paying all the bills. Since our neighboring states are doing better, taking Illinois jobs and businesses, Illinois workers and taxpayer families, they might as well just take the rest of Illinois too. Wisconsin can have Chicago and begin calling it South Milwaukee. Naturally, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel will fight this. He needs his job. And he'll most likely beg his friends at the New York Times and the Washington Post to write angry editorials to save him. And these will be a full concern for the Republic and those disposed of Midwestern salt-of-the-earth taxpaying Americans, as if, sadly, Wisconsin probably won't want Rahm either. So to spare hurt feelings, I propose carving out 40 acres around the mayor's home so Rahm might have, he could be the prince of his own country. Rahmania. And Cook County Board President Tony Taxwinkle, Preckwinkle, let me get that right, will fight it too. She needs something to smooth her ambitions. A grant of land as large as a case of soda pop she taxes so that she might stand on it and proclaim herself as queen of Taxwinkletopia. If there are portions of Illinois that the other states don't want, they may be left as a federal territory, a wilderness where only the strong survive. Peasants and friendly propagandists kneel and beg for crumbs. You already know the name of this wasteland. Madaganstan. And in return for taking care of our politicians, Wisconsin will probably demand assets, like the Milwaukee Cubs, the Sheboygan Bulls, and the Fond du Lac Bears. Indiana may want to carve a nice curvy slice out of former Illinois, so the state will be shaped more like a basketball, and that'll make the Hoosiers pretty stoked. And Indiana also gets the Indianapolis White Sox and the hottest soccer team in America, the Indianapolis Fire. Everybody's heard of them. Why not? Indiana's a great state with friendly people with Mitch Daniels and Kilroy's in Bloomington, Iowa. They can have the rest of the West. Missouri may get a small piece. Kentucky can take Southern Illinois, considering many on both of the sides of the border share Kentucky's DNA, as did Abraham Lincoln. A colleague told me he had reservations about sharing Illinois with the Bluegrass State. I wouldn't give Kentucky anything because A, it's South, and B, it's their state government is a mess too, with a governor who refused to talk to certain reporters. But beggars can't be choosers. If Illinois is dissolved as planned, we won't have a say in anything. And though some in Kentucky may not respect the media, the state does have excellent bourbon. I would allow Kentucky to send me countless barrels of its fine sipping spirit so that I might hold it in escrow to make sure everything goes as planned. I promise to sip their bourbon, light a cigar, hum a few sad bars from that song of the former Illinois that no one sings anymore. By thy rivers gently flowing, Illinois, Illinois. O'er thy prairies verdant growing, Illinois, Illinois. Comes an echo on the breeze, rustling through the leafy trees. Boss Madigan has us on our knees, Illinois, Illinois. Boss Madigan has us on our knees, Illinois. So the progressive example is on full display for everybody to see via state of Illinois. And of course, they're going to say, well, government didn't do enough. Government didn't promise everybody all these pensions. The government, think about it. If you were an employee for the city or city of Chicago, or maybe you were working for the state of Illinois and you were told, oh, yeah, when you get out, you get, half of your highest 3 years of pay for the rest of your life. And you've put in the time. You were obligated that. They promised you that. You'd be pretty livid if they pulled that away. But that's the problem. That was the old way of doing things back in the day with Ford and everybody else. And as those companies fell apart because pensions began to bloat over what they can do and take their entire weight and push it upside down and make the company fail, same thing's going to happen with the city. You can't look at the taxpayers as some endless stream of revenue. Oh, we'll just raise the tax rate some more. You know, at a certain point, you hit 100%. A certain point, the volume is filled. You know, you take the pitcher of water, starts to spill out the top because you filled it to the brim. Same thing's going to happen here. It's just simple economics. And when you've spent more than you can bring in and you can't take any more revenue, well, you're left with a failed state. And then you're left for other people that are doing well to bail you out. And you know what? We shouldn't get to that. We shouldn't bail this failed state out. Back in a second.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
While Illinois is collapsing under the weight of the socialist idea of big government and outdated retirement methods of simple pensions based on a perceived endless well of tax revenue that is going to prove to have a bottom, it's going to show that it's going to dry up, Seattle is learning another lesson of what happens when government mandates regulations on business, especially in the form of a higher minimum wage. From the New York Times, 3 years ago, Seattle became one of the first jurisdictions in the nation to embrace a $15 an hour minimum wage to be phased in over several years. Over the past week, two studies have purported to demonstrate the effects of the first stages of that increase, but with starkly diverging results. The first study by a team of researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, supports the conclusion of numerous studies before it that increasing the minimum wage up to a level that is about half or less than an area's typical wage leads to, at most, a small reduction in employment. That roughly describes Seattle, which first increased its minimum wage from $11 an hour from $9.47 an hour for large businesses in April 2015, then to $13 an hour for many of those businesses in 2016. Small businesses and large ones that provide health insurance for workers had done so as well. The Berkeley study focused on the restaurant industry because of the high proportion of restaurant workers who are paid the minimum wage. It found that for every 10% that the minimum wage rose, wages in the industry rose nearly 1%, and that there was no discernible effect on employment. But here's my interjection on this article. Let's remember that even though restaurants encompass anything from fast food to fine high dining, remember that many of these restaurants are server staff concepts. While they employ servers who are paid $2.15 an hour while receiving tips on top of their menial pay, many of these businesses, you know, your mid-levels, your Ruby Tuesdays, Chili's, Applebee's, Cheesecake Factory, these restaurants do comprise a good fair amount of the overall restaurant industry. Not only that, they've reduced the full-time employees and they've replaced them with more part-time employees, allowing more control on labor cost. Yeah, more jobs are added, but they're half the time on the clock. It's much easier to turn around and say, hey, you've been here for 13 hours. Go ahead and go home because we're slow when you have 20 hours as your max versus a 40-hour-a-week guy. You're not going to send him home after 13 hours. Eventually, he's going to quit. So you have a better regulation over cost, over labor cost at a part-time rate. So it's very deceiving what they're doing when they look at the restaurants, especially when you look at the restaurant industry as a whole. Not all of it's server-based, so reducing the labor force down to part-time workers may show that you've increased people, you've increased hiring, but you've also decreased time on the clock. And in a typical restaurant like this, especially in an example like Cheesecake Factory that I'm familiar with, your server staff is typically over twice the size of your hourly wage staff. And being that labor cuts would typically be forced in the direction of your higher labor, it would seem minimal when it's measured in that fashion. I mean, when you look at it and you say, okay, I've got 40 employees in the front of the house, and they're all paid $2.15 an hour, and they're getting tips on top of that, but then I've got the back of the house all getting hourly wages, and there's only maybe 10, 15 at most that come in the course of a week. Well, if their wages go up and their turnover begins to go higher because restaurants are laying them off because of the minimum wage hike, well, it's going to look like a starker, smaller issue. But going back to the article, by contrast, the second study, which a group of researchers at the University of Washington released on Monday, suggests that the minimum wage has had a far more negative effect on employment than even skeptics of minimum wage increases typically find, which neither study has been formally peer-reviewed. They wanted to make sure to throw that in. The University of Washington authors held one significant advantage over the Economist study in the issue: detailed data on hours and earnings for workers affected by the increase. This data allowed the researchers to measure the effects of the minimum wage on workers in all industries, rather than relying on restaurants as a stand-in, a common technique. It also allowed them to measure a change in hours worked, a potentially more complete indication of the effect of a minimum wage increase than the employee headcount that many studies use. The University of Washington researchers found that the minimum wage increase resulted in higher wages, but also a significant reduction in the hours of low-wage earners. This was especially true for the more recent minimum wage increase from as high as $11 an hour to up to $13 an hour in 2016. In that case, wages rose about 3%, but the number of hours worked by those in low-wage jobs dropped about 9%, a sizable amount that led to a net loss of earnings on average. But see, this is what happens when the minimum wage is forced higher by government mandate. You first have to consider the employees already receiving $15 an hour now have to have their wages raised in proportion to this new minimum wage hike. They're not going to be happy that everybody suddenly has, you know, risen to their income level by a government minimum wage. You have to see how this impacts your net profit. If you own a business, gross revenue, all the money coming in, minus all the expenses you have to pay out, and you forecast your taxes for the year so that you can cover them, all of that minus what's coming in is going to tell you how much you got left over. And that is your net profit. That's your profit margin. So if the negative impact on your profit margin is high enough, which many uninformed individuals will assume, oh, it's a big business, they got a huge profit margin, they make all this money, shareholders are just hoarding it. No, that's not the case. Many times their profit margin is very minimal. Even though they do maintain a healthy margin, not all of that margin is designated for pocketed profits. Some of it's allocated for expansion. Some of it's designated to renovation and revitalization of plant property and equipment. You know, all the stuff you use to make your business run. I mean, some of it's going to go to increasing your inventory size so you can make more revenue. That's your currency, increasing what you sell, whether it's your services, which means you have to hire more. Maybe you have a business where you're selling items. You want more inventory. You want to make that sale higher. You want to expand your revenue base. So some of it's going to go to research and development for new products and services. Maybe you want to step out in different directions and grow your business. And some will go to the shareholders as a return on investment. That's the reward they receive for risking the capital that they put on the line to start and maintain the business in the first place. Whether that capital is assets that they have, whether it's money, whether it's investments by other people, whether it's loans, whether it's credit, whatever the case may be. Again, and I've said this in the past, a business does not exist to give you a minimum wage job. You are hired as an employee because in your self-interested quest to earn money, you will then be motivated to help the vision of the business creators and owners who seek their goal, who hired you to help facilitate it. The big business isn't built to provide charity in the form of hiring. They're not there just to give everybody a job. And it isn't a relationship of top-down exploitation of the little guy they've hired. That's what a lot of people think, though. Oh, the big business, big corporation, they're running me dry. You know, that's the Sanders look, the Bernie Sanders people. They love to look at business like, oh, I'm a slave to this business. But you know what? Your self-interest to make money is what puts you in a symbiotic relationship with the business that hires you. Both self-interest are, from both parties, are involved in this situation. The employee is driven by looking to make as much money they can from a company they believe they're able to do, or are able to do so. Whether or not it's a short-sighted, you know, I need just enough money before I get to the next stage where I can find a different job, whether it's a stepping stone to something different, whether it's not even related to your passion or your education, you just need a job so you can pay your bills, you're going to go to the company that you think, well, I can at least get a pretty good paycheck from these guys. So your interest is at hand there. It's a symbiotic relationship. Both parties have something to gain from each other. And a couple decisions will be made once government regulation forces a financial burden on business. Either they're going to cut the staff and overload the remaining employees to perform the same level of productivity to get the same results they've had in the past and add additional stress to your life, to your force, to your job, or they can automate if the business will allow it to do so. McDonald's, prime example of that. CNBC reported that McDonald's will upgrade 2,500 restaurants to its, quote, experience of the future technology by year end, which includes digital ordering kiosk. The firm raises its rating on McDonald's to outperform to market perform, and price target for the shares go from $180 a share to $142. Same store sales estimates for 2018 raise to 3% from 2%. So once a company sees that the viable cost of labor, the variable cost of labor, which can be extremely inconsistent due to lack of work ethic, due to impaired work training, you know, there's more room for error. If they can look at that and see that it's going to be more rewarding to pay towards a controllable fixed cost asset like an automated kiosk, which can be depreciated on taxes, and the cost of the purchase of the equipment, the repairs, the upkeep of the equipment, all that cost and the installation of that equipment in the building, in the facility, is going to be how it's measured in the decision-making as to whether or not they go that route. But if the minimum wage was reduced, and this is where I go, you know, a lot of people just automatically assume cat's out of the bag, automation comes into play, and all of a sudden it's going to be permanent. Well, that's not necessarily the case. Because it's always going to be reviewed through cost. If the minimum wage was reduced, the cost of personal customer service versus an automated kiosk could be reversed, depending on the company's overall goals and proposed culture. It's going to simply come down to the cost of the company versus the regulations. It always does. Think of the oil industry. Even though we have the technology to frack, if it costs the same for another nation to expend their resources, and we will buy from them. And that's not a permanent thing. We started fracking, the price went down. Other people started being able to provide their resources for sale to us at a lower rate. We start buying from them, less fracking. I mean, think about it through the lens of, I'll use this as an example. I don't know if you're familiar with Johnny Rockets, a little burger joint. It's in a 50s style look. And every so often, the entire staff breaks out into some song like Grease or what have you. So if you look at it from automation from an economic level, you know, you look at it and say, well, is this business going to automate and stay that way forever because of the higher minimum wage? Or, you know, do you automate Johnny Rockets, or pay to have the experience of employees providing a 50-style burger joint. If government says $15 an hour, CEOs are going to look at it and go, it's automate. I mean, we don't have to pay somebody now. We can just pay it all up front and then depreciate it. But if they don't, if those costs don't outweigh it, well, then it's down to core competencies. It's down to what makes your company unique. What is the value added that you provide? Is it the experience? I mean, do you want the food to be it? Or do you want the food and the experience together to be it? Do you want to have people that can jump up on a table and start singing the 50-style thing as an attraction to people going, I want to go to that place because I enjoy that burger, but I also love that experience? If automation gets to a point where it's more expensive just barely to automate, they're not going to look at it and say, well, although I get consistency and I get product, with less waste, I'll take my chances on that if the experience is going to make me more competitive. I mean, the fact that you see cupcake shops, even antiquated business models, you know, old trades reemerging, shows that just because a business automates doesn't mean that it's completely automated forever. Doesn't mean it's gone forever. It doesn't mean that some niche business won't emerge. And if the market embraces it, the game has changed again. So the most automation is utilized that will be unchanged is if it can control quality, consistency, and cost. But if you're in a customer service-based industry, some automation will be sacrificed for that personal touch if it's economically feasible to do so. That's why manufacturing is the one that took the biggest hit with automation. You can control consistency, quality, cost. Customer service doesn't really exist when you're, it's not a trait when you're assembling and manufacturing. But, you know, in a customer service base, you know, technology, if that's going to provide a way around a minimum wage hike, they're going to look to do it. But if it doesn't, they may forgo that new technology for the, you know, for the customer service. Think of customization. Think of customized bikes, you know, motorcycles and what have you. If it's customized and it's an item that you craft by hand, you may not want automation because you want that handcrafted touch. Cost and profit margin will determine whether you decide to automate or not. But we need to exemplify how government overreach on a national level causes all of these decisions and consequences in business, and just you out there kicking a hacky sack around, eating your soy tofu burger, and complaining about big business exploiting you, there's a bigger side to it that you're not even taking into account. Stick with us on the other side of the break.
This is Adrian Slade.
Adrian Slade. Broadcast.
The big government socialist programs, the concepts, they're all collapsing in real time, whether it's overseas or here in America, as we've shown with Seattle's minimum wage hike, or the bloating of government with tons of departments with employees, enticing them with the promise of government-secured paid retirement, which is pushing the state of Illinois upside down. And the naive, indoctrinated, pseudo-enlightened progressive youth, they're not even recognizing it. They still gleefully clamor for it. You know, the other day, my son and I, were at the grocery store. We're down on the juice aisle, and he goes and sees a can of V8. I think it was like V8 Splash or something. And he sees the carrots, and he just screams out, "Carrots in juice? Yuck!" And, you know, I'm about to agree with him. I'm like, yeah, no kidding. I don't like carrots in my juice. And some bearded hipster comes down the aisle and says, "Yes, carrots in juice is great. You know what else is great? Kale." I wanted to drop kick him in his free-range, organic, sustainable throat. Maybe shank him with a broken craft beer bottle. Ow, what is that, an IPA? No, it's a Hefeweizen, you hipster douche. I mean, he looked like the chimney sweeper from Mary Poppins, although he didn't get dirty from a job. He got dirty just from his lifestyle choices of hanging out in mama's basement and not taking a shower. But I realize that's not very Christian of me to say or think that. But these same individuals are the ones that think libertarian socialism is an actual concept. I mean, both of those terms are diametrically opposed to each other. We talked about that on a podcast about a year ago. It's like being a carnivorous vegan. I mean, they're magnetic polar opposites. These people believe in democratic socialism. Ooh, that sounds great. Democratic socialism. Is that the best of both worlds? Pure democracy, that leads to collectivism. Socialism leads to total control, totalitarianism. So let's put the two together. Democratic socialism is basically the collective's desire to have a totalitarian in charge. A willingness for the majority to support an authoritarian leader. That's a pretty scary concept, if you ask me. But why would they even want to go down this road? Why is this even a phenomenon? Well, education is a huge part of it. Check this out from The Blaze. A new report has found that more than 100 colleges are now offering undergraduate and/or graduate students the option for obtaining a degree, majoring or minoring in social justice, or earning a concentration or certificate in that field. According to a report by Tony Erkinson, I guess that's how you pronounce the last name, at the College Fix, the Fix found that 64 American colleges that offer minors in social justice or sustainability, similar fields such as social justice leadership, at least 18 offer four-year degrees in fields, and at least 15 offer master's degrees in these studies. For instance, Rutgers University, a public college in New Jersey, offers its students a minor in social justice. To complete the program, students must take a variety of leftist courses, including practical social justice, which mandates students to participate in left-wing causes. According to the course description, practicing social justice will introduce students to diverse practices of social justice activism, including grassroots organizing, labor organizing, political organizing, all of those are Obama concepts anyways, and transnational organizing. Readings about social change efforts are combined with students' participation in community mobilizations, labor organizing efforts, political campaigns, and transnational social movements and NGO activism. That really stuck out to me. That's the non-governmental organization activism. Think about democracyalliance.com. Think about the white helmets that we talked about and who set the marketing theme to white helmets. Purpose.com. Think about the Soros-styled nonprofit activist organizations that we've gone on and on about on this show. Indivisible Guide and Indivisible.us. Those are all NGO activist groups. So they're teaching this stuff in the higher education. Going back to the article, for instance, the University of Missouri offers students a minor in social justice, which the university says involves the idea that in a perfect world, all citizens would have identical social benefits, rights, protections, and opportunities regardless of their backgrounds and membership in diverse groups. Recognizing that the world is not perfect, the primary goal for the minor in social justice is to enhance sensitivity to vulnerable and at-risk populations, to provide opportunity to critically review all social policies and the allocation of societal resources, to stimulate interest in advocacy and the planned change process. The social justice degree program at Eastern Kentucky University focuses on situating a multitude of local contestants over justice with a more expansive economic, political, and social context. This entails serious consideration for struggles for social justice, by which we mean conflicts and struggles about a diversity of social issues where human dignity, equality, and solidarity are at stake, economic inequality and poverty, institutional racism and classism and sexism and heterosism and corporate and state power, colonialism and imperialism, war and state violence, environmental harm and consumerism and commodification, corporate media influence and struggles over space, place, and territory. Other than becoming full-time leftist protesters, it's unclear what the jobs that will be available for these graduates of social justice programs will actually be. But they'll go out and make a nonprofit organization and save the world. Check this out from the passage from Everyday Women's Gender Studies College textbook, which was printed this year. The contemporary white wedding under multinational capitalism is, in effect, a mass-marketed, homogenous assembly line production with little resemblance to the utopian vision many participants hold. The engine driving the wedding, talking about the wedding industry, the wedding market has mostly to do with the romancing of heterosexuality and the interest of capitalism. The social relations at stake, love, community, commitment, and family, come to be viewed as secondary to the production of the wedding spectacle. I mean, this is what we're dealing with. And they look to frauds like Elizabeth Warren, who received her degree by claiming minority status as a Native American when applying to Harvard Law, claiming she's 1/16th Cherokee. We find out later she has no Native American blood. She used it to bolster her law career by listing herself as a minority for hire in a directory, specifically for minorities. She isn't even listed as a minority with the Senate. And then there's old Bernie Sanders. His wife is under federal investigation. So, you know, look at what happened to Trump. Same thing, same shoe on this foot regarding a real estate deal in association with the university that she helped bankrupt. These are their champions. Do as I say, not as I do. They want free college. They want free health care. They want to lower the cost of the economically distorted health care via government. When government comes in, price is where demand and supply meet within a margin of error, within a profit margin. You cannot mandate a lower price because then everyone else has to figure out how to make their price viable with what the government has mandated because the government has the big deep pockets of tax revenue. You cannot mandate or legislate economies of scale, which helps lower price. None of that's possible through regulations and legislation. You know, you cannot mandate price points without a disruption in the market price for everyone else. And if you want Alan Grayson, Sheila Jackson Lee, the once millennial who thinks we planted an American flag on Mars, or even Hank Johnson, who stated that Guam would tip over and capsize due to overpopulation, you want all these idiots making your life choices, then go ahead, push for total government control of your life. I, for one, cannot cede my freedom to this collection of jackasses. Back in a second.
This is Adrian Slade.
Adrian Slade Broadcast.
Welcome back. I kind of wanted to finish this off with the reason why I despise big government. It's why I spend so much time articulating minimum wage hikes as a horrible idea in Seattle. It's why I point out the failures of big government employment, Keynesian, which I call true voodoo economics, and even nationalized healthcare. It's why I side with small government libertarians. But then there's a line I cannot cross, and that's where libertarians look at things. They look at things as not only free markets and very, very minimal government, they even look at open borders. They use the concept of competition and free markets and apply it to immigration, and I couldn't be more against that idea. That's where I go as a conservatarian. I have libertarian tendencies. I have conservatism also mixed in. It's a hybrid. Libertarians completely lose me on national security. That's my divide. When they go, oh, well, we can't do anything about what's going on overseas. Yeah, I'm not one to intervene. I'm not one to go overseas and say, well, we need to fix this. But if we are getting threats by the overseas enemies, we need to take those seriously. Recognize evil is in the world due to sin. Free markets themselves, they're perfect. That is a perfect system. It's the sinful people who ruin it. It's the ones that get greedy. It's the ones that want to exploit. Virtue keeps it all in check. In a perfect world, yeah, you can have open borders, not worry about those coming in and out. But Al-Qaeda proves otherwise. Evil is always around. Conversely, you can't legislate evil out of the world either. You can't regulate evil away. Progressives believe they can. And just as evil can infect free markets and open borders and cause corruption, that same infection of evil can go towards power-seeking totalitarians that are progressive. You must have minimal government with maximum virtue to give unfettered natural rights while adhering to a self-imposed boundary. That self-imposed boundary is a fear, or for better term, a respect of a higher power that you don't want to disappoint, that mandates you to be kind to your fellow man, that mandates you to work ethically with your brothers and sisters, your friends, your neighbors. You don't want to step over those boundaries. You recognize them. You fear them, which means you respect them. You know, we also need to maintain the government as a minimal situation. National security, law enforcement, those are government functions. National security federally, law enforcement locally. And the founders understood arming the citizenry would offset the function of a local law enforcement. It's displayed right there in the Federalist Papers. That whole well-regulated militia, well then, the citizenry would outnumber that well-regulated militia and keep them in check. A citizenry void of values and morals is due to a number of problems, a number of things, the destruction of the family, the vilification of faith. Not only the vilification of faith, the progressive public education system, even higher learning, which we talked about earlier. The founders understood all of this. I mean, the communist goal is to break down the family. The Bolshevik Revolution, the goal of destroying republicanism and globalizing communism, has been something they've done since day one. And the media has always been used by the progressives that adopt the communist manifesto to infect the culture. It's why the news is focused on what they want to happen, but not what is really happening. So if we employed that boundary of fear and respect of a higher power, we would overcome most sinful desires, which would self-regulate business ethics and free markets and make us charitable as well. Happy Independence Day to you guys out there. Stay safe and remember those that fought and died to give us the freedom we enjoy. I'm Adrian Slade. Thanks for tuning in. You can listen every Saturday in the morning, 9 a.m., Talk America Radio. You can listen every Sunday, 8 a.m. on Talk American Radio, both Eastern Standard Time. You can hear my podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn app, Spreaker. Find my free Roku web channel on the Roku streaming store, the Adrian Slade Show Roku channel. You can also read my blog at adriansladeshow.com. We'll see you next time. God bless. Good night.